During this week together, we're thinking about the underside of greatness, if you will, those things that occur that don't make the headlines but do make us into men and women God would have us be, as we saw yesterday in Daniel 23, verse 10. In Job 23:10, God knows the way that we take, and when he has tried us, we will come forth as gold. I just saw this morning in Psalm 139 that little comment, he scrutinizes my path. He is intimately acquainted with all my ways. It's easy to forget that, especially when the days aren't as we planned them. When we have to deal with just plain old bad days. I don't think I've ever heard a talk on what I'm going to talk on today, just dealing with and handling bad days. Now, understand bad from our perspective. My heart went out to the pastor, for example, who put this literally happened in an Alabama newspaper. He put this announcement, and he meant well by it. It just got misprinted. Just listen. Taylor Homecoming. Homecoming services will be held October 2 at Taylor Methodist Church. Sunday school will begin at 10 a.m. with Lavelle Parker, teacher. Pastor Johnny McCurdy will preach at 11 a.m. Lunch will be held at noon in the fellowship hall. The congregation will sin from 1 to 2 p.m. He didn't mean that to come out that way, but I'm sure it made a tough day for him. You'll say dumb things from the pulpit, as I have done more times than I want to remember. I remember up in Boston, I was preaching on Joshua, and I was describing how they were to circumscribe the wall. I didn't say circumscribe, but I meant to say that they were to, you know, march around the wall. I don't know why you say dumb things like that, but you do. And when we were home for the holidays, Cynthia and I had a wonderful slumber party with all of our grandkids. It was kind of wild. Grandkids are better when you first are with them than when you've been with them for a while. But it was great to start with, and we all had sleeping bags, and we spilled out all over the living room, and we fixed a fire and roasted marshmallows. We took them to see the Jungle Book. They thought that was great, and we fixed s'mores, and then the next morning, Cynthia made one of her famous country breakfasts, and it was terrific. It was great to get them back to their parents when it was all over. And one of the things I love to do with our grandkids is read to them. And one of my favorite books is Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day by Judith Viorst. She's one of my favorite writers. She writes children's books for adults, if you know what I mean. You read to children, and they don't think it's that funny, but adults just crack up at stuff like this because to them, that's the way life is. For example, listen to a little bit of Alexander's A Day. It's a little kid about 4 or 5 years old, whose day just collapses on him, okay? I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. And when I got out of bed this morning, I tripped on the skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink. The water was running. I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At breakfast, Anthony got a Corvette Stingray car kit in his breakfast cereal box. Nick found a junior undercover agent code ring in his breakfast cereal box. But in my breakfast cereal box, all I found was breakfast cereal. I think I'll move to Australia, says Alexander. At school, Mrs. Dickens liked Paul's picture of the sailboat better than my picture of the invisible castle. At singing time, she said I sang too loud. At counting time, she said I left out 16. Who needs 16? I could tell that it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I could tell that because Paul said that I wasn't his best friend anymore. He said that Philip Parker was his best friend and that Albert Mayo was his next best friend. I was only his third best friend. I hope you sit on a tack, I said to Paul. Hope the next time you get a double-decker strawberry ice cream cone, the ice cream part falls off the cone part and lands in Australia. He's got a thing on Australia. After school, my mom took us all to the dentist, and Dr. Fields found a cavity just in me. Come back next week, and I'll fix it, said Dr. Fields. Next week, I said, I'm going to Australia. On the way downstairs from the dentist's office, the elevator door closed on my foot. And while we were waiting for my mom to get the car, Anthony made me fall where it was muddy. And when I started crying because of the mud, Nick said I was a crybaby. While I was punching out Nick's lights for saying crybaby, my mom came back and nailed me for being muddy and for fighting. I'm having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. When we picked up my dad at his office, he said I couldn't play with his copying machine. But I forgot. He also said to watch out for the books on his desk. And I was careful except for my elbow. He also said, don't fool around with his phone, but I think I called Australia. My dad said, please don't pick him up anymore. It was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Well, there were lima beans for dinner. I hate limas. There was kissing on TV. I hate kissing. My bath was too hot. I got soap in my eyes. My marble ran down the drain. I had to wear my railroad train pajamas. I hate my railroad train pajamas. Went to bed, and Nick took back the pillow he said I could keep forever. The Mickey Mouse nightlight burned out. I bit my tongue. The cat wants to sleep with Anthony and not me. It's been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. My mom says some days are like that, even in Australia. Now, you hear that. Some of you are already reading the Greek text. You're bored hearing stuff like that. And others of you are thinking, it'll never be that bad. That's just some gal's imagination. It may not be in any of those details, but you'll have days like that. Nobody has ever talked from a pulpit that I've ever been in attendance on this subject. So I decided I'd talk on this. There will be days like that. And you will begin the day with the best of reasons and motives and plans, and it is incredible how it will unravel on you. You will help your wife with the babies, and you'll be burping one of them, and you know it's 10 minutes before you have to leave, and it'll just throw up all over your collar, and you'll every time you preach and look at your notes, it'll smell sour. You won't have time to change. You don't have any other suit to wear. It'll just be hanging there, you know. And that'll be the day that some critic near the front of the church will frown all the way through the message, or you'll say something a little out of line. You try to be funny and it won't be funny. Or you'll try to be right and some scholar will point out a detail that you missed by half a millimeter. And it'll be one of those days. To my delight, I have found days like that in Scripture. I'm sure it wasn't a delight to those it happened to, but as I see them, I find it very realistic. And back to one of my favorite guys, David, over in 1 Samuel chapter 30. Turn there first. You're going to see a situation that was a terrible, horrible, bad day. My concern is not so much about the day, but how to handle it. What do you do to get past them or to deal with them since they're going to happen? I mean, you can't keep a paper from misprinting things. They have the ability to do that regularly. You can't keep yourself from saying words you shouldn't say as you're, you know, rolling on in a message or as you're teaching his class. You'll come out with something you didn't plan to come out with, or you'll lash out at somebody when you know better, but you're on edge about something. On and on it goes. Now, in this case, the background's significant. I want to give you three quick little vignettes from David's life. And all three are bad days. They seem to get worse. This first scene, he's been sent away, and his men have been sent away from an area where they had found some sense of refuge. And when you get to chapter 30, verse 1, I like the way the text begins, and it happened. This is how days like that occur. And it happened. When David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, so pause for a moment and imagine riding on horseback for 3 days. You're hot, you're dirty, you're tired, you're ready for home. You anxiously await the arms of your wife around you, and the love of your children and the joy of quietness and leisure and refreshment there with your family in Ziklag. And on that moment when they arrived, the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. You got to imagine that, because you can't think of it sitting here in Chafer Chapel. You can't picture it correctly. You're on horseback. You come up over the rise. You're looking down into Ziklag, and suddenly all hell has broken loose. And the place is smoldering remains of a fire. And they had taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and had carried them off and went their way. You're ready to put your arms around your loved ones, and suddenly you not only have them gone, you have no home. There is no tent in which to find protection from the elements. There is nothing but the charred remains of what was once your place of residence and the memories of your mate and your children. Where in the world could they be? For all they knew, immediately they had been killed. Verse 3, when David and his men came to the city, it was burned with fire. Their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. I love the next verse. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept. Isn't that a refreshing moment of vulnerability for this grand man of God? He just cried. Keep the tear ducts open, men and women. You'll need to leave room for that. If we have room for laughter, if we have room for excitement and enthusiasm, we must leave room for sadness and tears. Something is wrong if you go through 4, 5, 6 years in training here and you forget how to cry, or you don't give yourself the freedom to do so. The man and his warrior friends wept. Well, of course, until there was no strength in them to weep. David's wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Now, if that isn't bad enough, he jumps from the frying pan into the fire. David was greatly distressed. Best I can understand that Hebrew word, it's our word for depressed. He was as low as a whale's belly. He was at the bottom. He was distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. Now, I want to ask you, what in the world did David have to do with the burning of Ziklag? Nothing. He too has a broken heart. He just happens to be the leader. He makes a big target. And you will find when people are discouraged and embittered, you become the object of their anger. And you will wonder, what did I do to deserve this? I read the true story of a fellow that got on the bus that morning to ride to work. And all as he was riding along, he began to get sicker and sicker, really nauseated. And he thought, I have got to, you know, get rid of this breakfast. It's terrible. And they came to a stop, and a guy started to get on the bus. The door opened. The guy lost all of his breakfast on him, hits this guy. The door closes, and the bus drives him. Now, the guy... the guy on the curb has to wonder, what in the world? I'm just catching a bus to go downtown. I remember in our worship service when we decided we would no longer have the doxology every morning at the beginning of the worship service. We'd change it up. And we'd move all of the announcements to before the service begins. Announcements are stupid anyway, so they have nothing to do with worship. And I love the way we do it here. You get them all out of the way to begin with so that you can spend time on things that really matter as you get into it. Well, I tell you, you would have thought I canceled the rapture when we changed the whole thing around. I had one guy say to me, I didn't think the doxology would work anywhere else but at the beginning. I mean, it works wherever you do it. It's supposed to work anyway. But these people are going to stone David. Now, what did he do about it? He didn't attack them. He didn't lash back. He shows an incredible greatness of character. He strengthens himself in the Lord his God. Let me give you a thought. He refused to focus on the present situation only. That'll help you. When bad days occur, your tendency is to think all of life is this day, when in fact, very little of life is the one day when the bottom has dropped out. It makes for great preaching. It makes for tough living. I can talk about this better than I can practice it, and so can you. One pastor's wife puts it this way: my husband and I have occasionally felt on the edge of an ill-defined despair. Those were times when we felt a variety of things, a desire to either quit or run, a feeling of anger, the temptation to fight back at someone, the sense of being used or exploited, weakness of inadequacy, and the reality of loneliness. Such attitudes can easily conspire to reduce the strongest and the most gifted to a state of nothingness. Wow. I have been there. So have you, and so will we be at our own Ziklag. To get past the Ziklag and the mutiny of the troops around us, we have to make ourselves focus beyond the present, to remember the long view. He knows the way that you take. He is intimately acquainted with all of your ways and your days. Second vignette is in 2 Samuel 16. Again, the background is significant. Following the Bathsheba affair, the wheels came off David's cart. Everything that had worked stopped working. His life can be illustrated like a rooftop. Until Bathsheba, everything is on the up. From her on, everything drops. And it's a study in misery, misfortune, and heartbreak. His son, through conspiracy and manipulation, leads a coup, and knowing his father will not fight against him, Absalom takes charge, and David retreats in a sense of guilt and humility. David never was the father he should have been to Absalom or any of his children. That's another study we'll get into sometime. It's very revealing to see the strength of David on the throne and the weakness of David as a dad. He was a pathetic father. Absalom, raised in this context of royalty and wealth, and tutored by those who were around him rather than the touch of his father, who was busy about the business of reigning as king and living in the guilt of the Bathsheba backwash. Now David tucks his tail between his legs and scoots out the back door and leaves the throne for Absalom. We pick up the story at verse 5 of 2 Samuel 16, and just let your mind picture it. Now just stay with me through these next couple or three verses. Remember David's emotions. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, "Get out! Get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow." We would use other words today, but the Hebrew conveys the insult and the indignity of the man's verbal assault on David. When he's down, he gets kicked. "The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed." Wow. You know, the guy's a jerk. Let's just call it what it is. Anybody who kicks another one when he's down is a jerk. And let's learn a lesson through the other side of Shimei's life. What a terrible thing to do. In fact, Abishai, who's David's buddy, leans over and says, "Tst, hey, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head." I love the way that reads. Just, I mean, he won't know it till he sneezes. "I'll have that head off so quick." And this guy is a head-cutting-off guy. He's a fighter. How does David handle something like this? It's a bad day when this kind of criticism comes, and you'll get it, especially in unsigned notes and people with messages that they don't have the guts enough to sign. To stand behind. They won't talk to your front. They'll talk to your back. Really, other friends about you. The king said, "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, what have you done? Why have you done so?" David said to Abishai, and to all his servants, "Behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone. Let him curse." The Lord's in this. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursings this day. So David went on his way. And Shimei kept on. Shimei went along on the hillside parallel with him, and as he went, he cursed and cast stones and threw dust at him. I mean, it is really a man out of control. Critics won't stop, even when you handle it right. They won't stop. They'll keep criticizing. You handle it right, they won't stop. They'll keep on. Some have the gift of it, and they exercise it. But what a wonderful perspective David has. The king and all the people who were with him arrived weary. And again, we read he refreshed himself there. How could you refresh yourself with a Shimei on your tail? An Alexander the coppersmith who follows you from ministry to ministry. How do you cope with that? I don't care how good a scholar you are. That works at you, that eats at you, that steals your joy, robs your peace. He remembered that his God is still sovereign. That's how he coped. That's how you'll handle it. Oh God, you know how to silence lips. You haven't silenced these for some reason. I stand in your strength. I cannot silence anyone. You'll be amazed at your own inadequacy to change anybody. As powerful as you may be in whatever you may do, by the grace of God, you will be terribly impotent when it comes to changing sinful people. That's God's job. Good theology comes in handy on a bad day. David Roper, one of our graduates, a close friend of mine, and many of our faculty, writes this. A man once unloaded on me that I was a wicked shepherd who was destroying and scattering the sheep. Those were his exact words. I asked him if he knew that he was quoting scripture. He said he did. I asked him if he knew by whom it was said and about whom. He didn't. At that point, I told him that it was the prophet Jeremiah who first said it, 23:1, and that it was said about each of Judah's last four kings, Zedekiah, Shalom, Jehoiakim, and Coniah, four of the worst men who ever lived. I thought that would change his mind about me. It didn't. The best of Christianity is sometimes swallowed up by the worst, and often I think the worst is mean-spirited attacks upon our brothers. Makes outsiders think that becoming a Christian can turn someone into a swine. Something needs to be said to our critics. Our Lord was very clear about what to do if you have something against another person. He said, go and show him, your brother, his fault, and settle the matter just between the two of you. Matthew 18:15. The best way to handle a complaint against another is frontally. Though it may hurt initially, your loving concern can restore your relationship. Proverbs says that a faithful friend will wound if he must, 27:6. A real friend, as Ambrose Bierce observed, is someone who stabs us in the front. Correction is much easier to take if it is offered in humility and love. Critics need to lighten up, but the criticized need to toughen up. We mustn't let our detractors drive us to depression and despair. Hear this well, men and women. Every critique provides an opportunity to grow. Forget the critic. It's far more important to consider the criticism, especially if it comes from more than one source. As the old Yiddish proverb concludes, if one man calls you an ass, pay him no mind. But if two call you an ass, go get a saddle. 2 Samuel chapter 18 is the last scene, and we'll do this quickly. 2 Samuel 18, David wishes he had died rather than Absalom. If you ever lose a child and you're in the midst of guilt over your failure as a parent, you will understand David's anguish. He had failed miserably as a parent. He had tried his best to keep the life of Absalom. Joab, however, ignored it and murdered him. The word finally gets back. And when the king receives the word of his son's death, could there be a worse day? I don't know that there's any more emotional verse in all the Hebrew than verse 33 of 2 Samuel 18. The king was deeply moved, ragatz, to quake, to shake, to shudder, say Harris, Archer, and Waltke. Agitation growing out of some deeply rooted emotion, like writhing in birth pangs, literally trembling due to misfortune. The man is shaking. He has just heard of the death, the murder of his boy. He never made it right with Absalom. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. He is immobilized in grief. May God sustain you if that is your experience in the future. I've never known that kind of grief, but I've dealt with those who have. For over 30 years, I've had them in my arms and had my shoulder wet with their tears. It is a sadness that cannot be put into words. It is horrible days at its very worst. Here is a leader who is suddenly caught in the backwash of his own memory of failure and now the inability to ever make it right on earth. He's a leader, but he stops leading. It was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom." And the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, "The king is grieved for his son." And so instead of coming back into the city victorious after battle, they come back in sneaking around like rats on a sinking ship. The people went by stealth into the city that day as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. Joab watches this scene and knows that David's presence is significant for the whole city, his grief notwithstanding. The king, however, covers his face and cries with a loud voice. I'm sure you could have heard it from the chamber. Who knows, it may have been the very chamber where he had looked with lust upon Bathsheba years earlier. "Oh, Absalom," he cries out, "my son. My son." Joab came into the house and said, "Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines. Give it to Joab." At least he says it directly and personally and to his front. "By loving those who hate you and hating those who love you, for you have shown today princes and servants are nothing to you. I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, you would be pleased." David, there's some sense of selfishness in your grief. There's a bigger picture, David. You've got to face it. David thankfully took his counsel. Verse 8, arose and sat in the gate. He still grieves, but he puts it aside. When they told all the people, saying, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," then all the people came before the king. Verse 14 wraps it up. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah. His grief didn't let up. It intensified. However, how did he handle it? Finally, listen carefully. He realized his calling had a higher priority than his own personal loss. You'll need that someday. He realized his calling was of greater priority than his own personal loss. How do you go on through such days? Refuse to focus on the present only. Remember that God is sovereign. Even in the midst of this unfair treatment, realize your calling is of higher priority than any personal loss. And you will become great in the eyes of the people. Father, in the midst of this serious moment, we realize that our future really is in your hands. You know the end from the beginning. We know only the past and now. Use these simple, honest words to remind us of the truth when we will need it the most. For Jesus' sake.